ladies and gentlemen. It was in this month, 6 years ago, that a very gracious lady came to Britain. She was known professionally as Lillian Roth. She was an actress, as most of you probably know. Just as that lady came to Brisbane, I had emerged from a hospital. The third hospital in which I had been incarcerated, in an endeavor to get over the last of the many fenders that it has been to suffer. I came out of that hospital with the idea that so far as getting away from the curse of drinking was concerned, I had no possible hope. And when it was mooted to me that this lady had a plan whereby those who had become completely beaten because of their addiction to liquor could overcome their addiction and restore themselves to sanity and decency, you people who are alcoholics in this audience will readily appreciate that I tossed that suggestion aside as being absolutely ridiculous. Those of us who had sought the best that science could provide, the comforts and the advice that the medical people could give us, the good people of the religious orders, and the comfort of relatives and friends whose bona fides were beyond question, will readily understand why I could not possibly see that an actress from America had any possible scheme whereby I could overcome my particular affliction. With that screwy vanity, which is so characteristic of the alcoholic, I refused to have anything to do with what I thought was just a glamour girl. And I steadfastly refrained from making contact with this lady, despite the fact that my reputation as a drinker already was well known to her, and she had sought an interview with me. However, in obedience to the pleadings of my mother, I eventually decided that I would concede to this girl from America an interview of some minutes. And having done that, I would depart upon my way and wrestle with this problem alone. I did, in obedience to that promise, make contact with Lillian Roth. And I can assure the hardest thinking drinker here that what transpired up in her suite of rooms in Lennon's was truly unbelievable. She was only talking to me for a few minutes, and either thought I knew everything about the drinking game, became so completely engrossed in what this woman had to say, that within a matter of minutes, there came into me a hope that there might be some possible chance that the abyss of destruction could be avoided after all. And instead of spending a few begrudged minutes with her, I stayed with her for several hours and was only removed from the company of that woman because there were other people who wished to interview her in respect to her professional capacity. Such a profound effect did that woman have upon me that it was with great anxiety that I awaited a broadcast which she informed me she was about to make on that night. And knowing, of course, many alcoholics, I sought a couple of my friends, and I told them that this woman had something that was well worth hearing, and I took them along to hear her. The very next night, ladies and gentlemen, Alcoholics Anonymous was formed in Queensland. Five men, of which I was privileged to be one, met in a little flat in South Brisbane. And although we knew very little about it, being quite unable to absorb, and Lillian Roth being quite unable to give, the full significance and the full meaning of this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we nevertheless sat in this room and discussed, as well as we were able, this extraordinary thing that this woman had loosed upon the society of Brisbane. We met again, and we commenced to meet regularly. We sought literature. We sought information everywhere, and eventually we started to get some inkling of what Alcoholics Anonymous means. Enough of that, ladies and gentlemen, to tell you this, that unfortunately one of those five men has passed on. Another man disappeared. He left Brisbane. I've lost track of him. But as to three of them who were absolute and hopeless alcoholics, had been in every form of conceivable disgrace because of their drinking. Not one of those three men, of which, of course, I am one, to my knowledge, and I have knowledge of a certainty, has tasted alcohol in the intervening 6 years. And you can imagine, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, if in discussing myself to some extent, I do it with a feeling of profound pride and gratitude, in the knowledge that I now see before me in this very room, evidence, concrete visual evidence of the growth of this remarkable fellowship in the center of Brisbane. And with the knowledge that here associated with us tonight are representatives from other towns such as Toowoomba and other places, Ipswich, where the AA program has taken root and has grown. Now, ladies and gentlemen, before I go any further, I want to make reference to the fact that a very dear old member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who would for certain have been with us tonight, is lying ill in hospital. And I know perfectly well that this meeting being on as it is, his thoughts are with us. He is a man who heard that very broadcast of Lillian Roth on that night, who was in such a hopeless state, as he told us himself afterwards, that his daughter was feeding him with spoonfuls of brandy, and he thought that death was surely imminent. That man struggled in to find out something about AA. He joined up with our little group, and he has remained completely sober ever since. That man is Jack G., lying in hospital tonight, and awaiting a serious operation. Every member of Alcoholics Anonymous knows him, and what a great credit that man is to society in general, to have been brought back from the depraved state in which he found himself, to become a credit not only as the head of the magnificent family of which he is the head, but a splendid example to every man and woman in this community. And that is part of the work of Alcoholics Anonymous to transform that wreck into that splendid personality. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in case some of you might think, some of you who are here as visitors and do not know much about us, might think that we've got some sort of a fake show whereby we create some sort of a hysteria which enables us to convince ourselves that we've got some means of handling this drinking problem, which must eventually crash when the hysteria disappears. Let me quote to you from our copy of The Grapevine, which is the official paper of Alcoholics Anonymous coming from headquarters in America, something which has transpired in America. And I think it will convince any open-minded person, however doubtful he might be at this stage as to our bona fides. In America, there is an organization known as the American Public Health Association. I have taken the responsibility of going to members of the medical profession and inquiring into the standing and bona fides of this American Association. And I am assured by responsible members of the medical profession here that it is an organization of very high standing and of a great prestige in America. Now, in America, too, there is what is known as the Lasker Award, which is granted, or a series of them, granted each year to the person or to the body which is responsible for the most outstanding contribution to the social good for any particular year. To those of you who are unbelievers and think that we have got some sort of a sham show, I am going to quote a short excerpt from the citation associated with the Lasker Award, which was given to no less a body, acknowledging it as being responsible for the greatest contribution of the year to the social good and in remedying a social evil, to no other body than Alcoholics Anonymous. And, ladies and gentlemen, this is part of what it says. Chosen for the conspicuous honor by the American Public Health Association, Alcoholics Anonymous has been formally presented with one of the highly significant Lasker Awards for 1951. In recognition of its unique and highly successful approach to an age-old public health and social problem. Now, I'll not read the whole citation, but listen to this. Coming from the hard-headed people of America, historians may one day point to Alcoholics Anonymous as a society which did far more than achieve a considerable measure of success with alcoholism and its stigma. They may recognize Alcoholics Anonymous to have been a great social venture in a great venture in social pioneering, which forged a new instrument for social action, a new therapy based on the kinship of common suffering, one having a vast potential for the myriad other ills of mankind. Now, I know, ladies and gentlemen, that there are scoffers in every community. I know it from my early association with Alcoholics Anonymous. I know it from the know-alls and the wise people who seemed to think that they possessed an intellect far above that of their fellows, that this organization or fellowship, as we choose to call it, did not possess the bona fides which we early members of Alcoholics Anonymous really believed it did possess. I quote, therefore, this passage from that citation in order that you can make up your own minds as to whether or not this fellowship, which has brought so much happiness and peace into the homes of hundreds of people in this city and other cities in Australia already, is something which is to be acknowledged at least with respect and seriousness. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is not much use talking to anybody about Alcoholics Anonymous unless they are humble enough to listen to what we have to say. And some of the things which I'm going to say in this comparatively short address may sound prima facie to the person who's not convinced that he's an alcoholic insulting. And if they do, I'll be glad. For there's one way of piercing the skin of the vain peacock hypocrite that is the alcoholic, and that is by insulting him. I know, because it was one of the ways of throwing me. Ladies and gentlemen, and alcoholics in this audience who have not yet acknowledged that they are alcoholics, I want to tell you, because Alcoholics Anonymous authorizes me to tell you, that you are subnormal people. Of course, those of you who have money, and those of you who are in society, And those of you who are supposed to belong to the upper strata of society will immediately reject any suggestion that you belong to the subnormal class. But let me tell you, as a subnormal to other subnormals, that any man who is prepared to abdicate his responsibilities to his family, any man who is prepared to bring into the home of which he is a member, and in respect to many of which he is the acknowledged master, the disgrace and the worry and the distress and the ruin that the alcoholic brings into his home has one of two alternatives to choose from. He is inflicting that sadistic cruelty on those who are associated with him immediately and proximately in the home, and not so proximately in the various circles in which he associates, is doing that for one of two reasons. If he possesses any regard whatever for the basic decencies of life, he doesn't want to inflict tragedy and sorrow on those who love him and on those who are dependent upon him. Therefore, he will surely say this, if he had the opportunity of replying to me, "I do not do that by desire. I do not do that by design." And I agree with him. But what is the other alternative? If he doesn't do it by desire, and he doesn't do it by design, he does it by compulsion. And if he does it by compulsion, a compulsion to drink, and in the train of the drink, this mischievous and dastardly conduct, then he must acknowledge, if he has the brain to think, that surely there is something wrong in this compulsion making him guilty of this outrageous conduct. And this is what is wrong. He has fallen victim to the disease of alcoholism. He can analyze it as he likes. He can go to whatever doctors he likes. He can go to the professors and the wise men of the world if he likes. But in relation to alcoholism, they are no wiser than we are. We know what it's done to us, and we know what a compulsion it can create and does create. Let me tell him then, this potential alcoholic or this real alcoholic who has not made acknowledgement of the fact, that he can get rid of this obsession. He can get rid of this terrible handicap under which he's living. He can get rid of this disgrace. And instead of carrying on as an effigy any longer, the effigy of a man, dressed as he might be in fine raiment, and mixing as he might amongst the so-called upper strata of society, he can throw aside all that spurious outer garb and become what we have endeavored to become, and many of us, I claim, can legitimately say we have become, responsible, well-integrated, and decent people. If he will only be humble enough, therefore, to listen to me as a spokesman for AA and not in my personal capacity at all, he will learn, if he's a wise man, he will learn with a profound degree of pleasure that what he has secretly considered in himself to be a defect in his moral character, to be guilty of such rottenness towards those to whom he should show kindness and consideration, he will get great comfort indeed in the knowledge that he is suffering from a disease just as assuredly as many of the poor incurables are suffering from diseases in the various hospitals in this city tonight. And once he acknowledges this fact, once he realizes this fact, that he's not a bad man, that he's not a rotten man at all, that he's doing this thing under a compulsion, surely then, and when he realizes that we have the answer in Alcoholics Anonymous, he'll do something about it. If he doesn't, that man is rotten, that's all. That's all. The moral responsibility arises once he knows that he is suffering from a disease. Of course, he could put up this spurious argument. If I'm suffering from a disease, and I can't help what I'm doing, what can I do about it? How can you blame me? There is no escape by that door, let me tell the alcoholic unacknowledged. Alcoholics Anonymous shows him that that's where the moral responsibility begins. And all his greatness outside, all his parading before his fellows, and all his appearances in the press and elsewhere must go by the board as prime considerations for living. What is the prime consideration for living, ladies and gentlemen, is this: that you have acknowledged at last that you are a subnormal person in relation to liquor. And it's as plain as the nose on your face. Your conduct, repeated over and over again, the causing of the terrible trouble, those who have had to live with alcoholics, and those of us, even when we were sober, who knew other alcoholics, the terrible upset in the stomach of those at home, the dread that that alcoholic, if he doesn't turn up, might be found in a hospital, in a jail, or killed. And then when he does turn up, to turn that home from what it should be, a place of refuge from the worries of the day and some sort of peace and harmony, into a torment and a ferment. If he will acknowledge, therefore, that he belongs to that class, and if he uses his intelligence at all, there's no escape from that ultimate conclusion, then this is the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. That he has acknowledged that alcohol has got him beaten and that his life has become unmanageable. His life has become unmanageable. Because, ladies and gentlemen, he's suffering from a threefold disease. We do this little bit of basic thinking. Man is not comprised just of flesh and bone. Man has a physical makeup, of course. He has a mental makeup, that's acknowledged. But man has another makeup, that's his spiritual makeup. And we've discovered that the alcoholic, for some reason, unknown, completely inexplicable, becomes diseased, upset, chaotic, if you like, in all three facets of his nature. And the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous is to enable him to straighten out, to make healthy those three facets of his nature. We know perfectly well, of course, how ill we become physically. That needs no stressing. For only those of us who have been alcoholics can know what that illness is like. You can, ladies, can have what you like thrown in. It's the worst suffering on earth. Ladies and gentlemen, those of us who are alcoholics know what the mental suffering is like. The mental torture of the alcoholic. That torture which drives men to suicide. Men with money, many of them, men with position, men with prestige, driven to suicide. Why? Because of the mental torture that only the alcoholic knows. And we think if we could only get ourselves mentally right, and we could get ourselves physically right, that would be the end of our trouble, that we would be no longer different to other men, that we'd be able to go down the street and have a drink, like our fellows who can have a drink and can drink socially. Oh no, we can't. We fail to realize that we are ill spiritually, that our relationship with the great unknown, the great universe, too, has become distorted. And so we set about in most profound humility, not trying to set ourselves up as any Bertrand Russells or anybody of that description, who will explain everything but the first cause, who will start off accepting a premise, however be that as it may. We set out in profound humility to try and make ourselves healthy in all three respects. And the first step, therefore, is to humbly acknowledge that we're beaten, that alcohol has got us beaten, and that our lives have become unmanageable. And when we have taken that step, not taken that step in any sort of lip service to it, and once you have got that step over, then you're on the way to AA. But until you've got that step over, it's no use coming into Alcoholics Anonymous at all. Be one of the wise men. Set yourself up with that great brain of yours and carry on. And the best thing you can do with it is hit it hard against a brick wall, because that's the only way of getting any sense into it. I know, because I am an alcoholic. I'm not saying of you anything that I'm not prepared to say about myself. But then, ladies and gentlemen, when we have done that, we realize this. We have sought everything that science could provide. We have been made completely physically sober. We have been nursed back to physical health. Some of us have discussed matters with psychiatrists in order to try and straighten out our minds and our thinking. But we found that it doesn't matter where we went for help. We couldn't get it. We went to men of religion in a bargaining sort of way. As much as to say, all right, God, if you keep me sober, I'll think a lot of you. Something of that description. We went here and there, we sought all sorts of quack medicine. And every conceivable effort was made on the part of our relatives and well-wishers to keep us sober. None of them succeeded. So when we come into AA, we realize that there is no power on earth, no human power, which can keep us sober. And if you go up to the watch house tonight and see the poor unfortunates that are there as derelicts, discarded by society, you will realize that society is at its wit's end in relation to the alcoholic. It can do nothing for him, and we know perfectly well that that is true. So we must look beyond. Look beyond human aid. We're lost. We belong to the lost, absolutely. And therefore, we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And this deals with the spiritual side of our program. Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't think for one moment that I'm going to start talking religion to you. I'm not. We have no religion as such in Alcoholics Anonymous, and any reference to religion at all is referred to only in the broadest possible sense. But we are bound to believe this. Otherwise, we're not following the steps. And if you're not following the steps, you're not carrying out AA. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Most of us, fortunately, have now, even if we had not on coming into AA, a belief in some orthodox religion. And we are prepared, therefore, to believe that there is, operating in some way, absolutely unintelligible to our finite minds, a strange and mystic power, which, if permitted to enter and take its part in the control of our lives, will enter. And that's not the talk of a religious crank. You will find, when you're humble enough to acknowledge that this power can enter into your life, that that chaotic state of mind, together with the practice of the other steps, which I will refer to briefly in a moment, will enable you, who throughout your drinking career as an alcoholic has not known one moment's peace, and I'll defy any alcoholic who is unacknowledged yet as an alcoholic to contradict me when I say that from the time we became alcoholics, that's compulsive drinkers, when we passed from the realm of social drinkers across that thin dividing line into the realm of compulsive drinkers, we have not known one moment's peace, real peace of mind, for this strange reason, that when we were sober, there was some strange compulsion, we know it now to be a compulsion, gnawing at us, flaying us, driving us back to the drink. And eventually, we could resist it no longer, and the first drink was taken, and that's the end of the alcoholic. It's not the 101st. And once we took that drink, and we got into the deplorable state which inevitably was our lot once we took the first drink, there was one craving we had on earth, and that was to become sober again, and we couldn't. And for 20 years and more, that was my life. That's the life of every alcoholic. He can't go down to the hotel or into the lounge or anywhere else like the ordinary normal fellow and have his few drinks and take his place in society as a normal man and go home and conduct himself as a responsible man in his own home again. He can't. And although he wants to do those things, he suffers the agony of mind of knowing that he can't. And although you may see him grinning like a Cheshire cat in a bar, I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that deep down in the mind of that man is the knowledge that unfortunately he's got to keep himself drunk because he can't face up to the reality again of being without it. And when eventually, either in a hospital or elsewhere, having come through the tremendous torture that is the recovery from a bender, he gets sober again. And after a while, that strange compulsion, that strange uneasiness, And any wife of an alcoholic listening to me tonight will know when the portents and the signs became clear, when he became unbearable, when he blamed the wife for everything. And eventually, the great day came. He was back in the bar again. Now, ladies and gentlemen, every decent man that's an alcoholic knows, man and woman knows, that state of affairs persisted. There was no such thing as that magic thing that's known as serenity of mind. And let me tell you, people, and you don't need telling, those of you who have anywhere reached near my age at all events know this, that there's only one real happiness in life, and that is serenity of mind. You can have all the money in the world, you can have all the prestige in the world, and you can have all the social standing in the world. But we know now that we've passed the mad impulses of youth, that there is one great thing in life and one great thing only, and that is to be able to sit with a peaceful, serene mind, analyzing things with a sane and equitable sense of value. That was unknown to the alcoholic. It was unknown to the alcoholic's family. It was unknown to his children. They never got a break. That's part of the disease. And if any word that I can say from this platform tonight, although I'm not here indeed as a recruiting sergeant or anything of that description, which can help to knock it into a man's mind sufficiently to say, I'm beaten this night. I'm completely beaten. I put myself abjectly and without reservation into the hands of Alcoholics Anonymous, then it will be one of the greatest things that I've ever achieved in my life. Ladies and gentlemen, as I spoke with gratitude at the start, that goes for every member of AA. For those of us who have done 12th step work, and I'm not going to try to explain everything to you, ladies and gentlemen, in this address, we have had this tremendous pleasure in life. We have seen, I have had the privilege of seeing many, I think I could say hundreds, in AA, coming into AA, talking to me, and telling me that my problems were never like theirs. Nobody on earth had any worry like they had. I've seen them down. I've seen people without hope. Knowing what they were suffering, the other people of the community mightn't realize it, but another alcoholic realizes it. They had lost the last vestige of hope and came to me in some sort of a desperation as they go now to varying members of Alcoholics Anonymous to discuss their problems with them. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm not talking in any platitudes when I say this, that one of the greatest thrills a man can get, or a woman in AA can get, is to see the hope being restored into eyes that were formerly hopeless. I have not seen it in units. I have seen it happen in hundreds, where people who had given themselves away have, through the influence of this extraordinary fellowship, again being restored to the full stature of full-sized men and women. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is not within my power in the short time allotted to me in this address to give you even a remote idea of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the first thing, as I tried to tell you, is this: recognize you are suffering from a disease. Recognize this, too, that when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't ask you to take a pledge. We don't ask you to swear off drink for life. Oh, no, that's too much of a shock to a man whose life has become absolutely dependent on alcohol. But we say this to you. We have a 24-hour program, and we live in day-tight compartments of 24 hours at a time. We concentrate on keeping sober this one day at a time, and one day added to another day makes up a lifetime. And by that means, ladies and gentlemen, some of us now have enjoyed continuous sobriety extending over a period of 6 years. We therefore offer you our 24-hour program. Don't balk at it. Just think of it for a while. How many of you men and women have sat and thought of what you were once were? The old pug, for instance. The great old fighter. What he might have been once. And, of course, the new man comes along. And the young fellow comes onto the scene and he's thrown aside. The old fellow must give way. He sits and broods about it, and eventually you see him a drooling drunk. worrying about what he once was. The great actor that once got the plaudits of the thousands and is no longer in demand, sitting brooding about what he once was. What's it matter if they flapped their heads off in the years gone by, or they hurrayed for him at the stadium, or the great professional man that was once at the top of the tree in his profession? If today he's sitting in a park, burying his hand in his head, his head in his hands, and worrying about he once was. We all did that. We all knew we were on the toboggan, down, 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 and a clean suit in the morning, if we had one, was no excuse, was no savior for us to keep us from that toboggan. Ah, no, we say that's gone. If we were a failure yesterday, what's it matter if we're a success today and we're living that success in our day-tight compartments of 24 hours? What's it matter if we were the hero of yesterday, if we're the park dweller of today? Does it make sense? So we say that continuous today's, an eternal present, as it were, is the secret of living a sane and a successful life. Likewise, ladies and gentlemen, we don't sit in apprehension for the future. We don't sit worrying about what the position is going to be in 10 years' time. But when we were alcoholics, we did. We added to the worries of today, the regrets of yesterday and the fears for tomorrow, a burden which no human mind could carry. That's, of course, why we were so completely chaotic. So we've given that away, too. And we know that the insurance, the best insurance for tomorrow, is to tackle the jobs that are before us today and to do them as well as sane and responsible people can do them. And when you do the appropriate thing for today, that is the best preparation to meet, so far as human agency can meet, the problems that are going to arise tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, we have what we call our 12th step program. We don't go coddling anybody. Unfortunately, some mothers and wives bring us up and say, "My husband's on the booze, come out and get him off." Well, be just too funny, particularly if he's a big fella. You see, ladies and gentlemen, we can do nothing without the cooperation of the person concerned. And until the person concerned is prepared to get away from the alcoholic cowardice, the cowardice that converts a man into a cur, whether he's well-dressed or otherwise, and is prepared to acknowledge defeat, then we can do nothing for him. But in our 12-step work, we assure you of this, that once we are satisfied that a man is genuine, once we are satisfied that he really wants Alcoholics Anonymous, there is no member of Alcoholics Anonymous that will not extend the hand of friendship, the hand of help, will not give him the explanations, the talk about his own experiences, and will not go to any reasonable lengths whatever in order, as I say, to make that gleam of hope appear in the eye which was formerly hopeless. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the 6th anniversary. You may want tests. You may want tests as to whether this is a success. If I tell you that I could call up from this audience, if I chose and they would be willing to come, men and women who have been metho addicts, men who have a record of convictions for alcohol as long as your arm, would you say then it was a success? If I can give you the practical test, and there are men and women who would be prepared to come out of this audience and testify and bear their testimony by proofs that they have been so far gone that they lost every vestige of human decency, that they were prepared to live like animals and batten on the rest of society. I'm not saying this out of any sense of disrespect, of course. But everything in this world is surely proved by evidence. And the best evidence you can produce in anything is an example or a series of examples where certain theories and tests have proved absolutely successful. And if people who are not yet completely gone down want some proof that this thing can work. And these people come forward who formerly slept in parks and went right down to the lowest standard to which man can descend, and today are taking their place in this community with the same degree of respect and dignity as is the governor himself, will you acknowledge to me then, in your sense of fairness, that Alcoholics Anonymous has something which is not to be found in any other organization or within the power of any other individual in the world? Let me make, therefore, on this birthday meeting, acknowledging as I acknowledge, and on behalf of the other members of Alcoholics Anonymous acknowledge, our gratitude to those people who brought it to Australia, and to the greatest of great men, Bill, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous himself, acknowledging our gratitude and our thanks for enabling us, who were the pariahs of society, enabling us, who were the destructive elements in our own home, enabling us, who were the disgrace of the suburb in which we lived, enabling us, who made default in giving help and carrying the burdens of others when by right and by responsibility we were called upon to carry them. To give us, who caused such terror and such misery and such disgrace, the right to walk the streets with the full stature of human dignity, which is the birthright of every decent person, enabling us, for whatever time we might still have to live, to observe those basic decencies which were always recognized by us, to carry out the tenets which were instilled into us when we were kids and when we were young people, before we fell victims to this dread disease. To think that this humble fellowship has given us the right not only to redeem ourselves, not only to make some reparation to those that we injured, not only now to carry the burdens for those who are old and dependent upon us, and to bring back into that suburb some degree of respect to the old home in which we lived, but to enable us to go out into the world and take by the hand some other poor wretch which is struggling in that mire and help him onto his feet in order that he again may be able to proceed with the mantle of dignity again descended upon his crushed shoulders. Ladies and gentlemen, you will not think, therefore, that I'm speaking in any terms of extravagance when I say that Alcoholics Anonymous has become second to our religion. That's a matter entirely for the personality himself, second only to our religion, and next to that, indeed, has become the most important thing in our lives. And if I were asked, speaking personally, what honor I would like conferred upon me in this state or in any other state of society, I mean this when I say that the greatest tribute and the greatest respect that any people can pay to me is to have been a good and honest member of Alcoholics Anonymous.